ABC Radio, it's Nightlife with Sarah McDonald.
Well, on Wednesday, it'll be 75 years since the fall of Singapore, probably the darkest day in the Pacific War, as the much relied upon defences of Singapore were unable to stave off the Japanese military. Of course, the fall of Singapore had a direct impact on the lives of so many Australians, of the men and the women who were killed, of course, and the families around them, the ones who spent years in the notorious Changi prison, the families back home, the nurses and civilian whose boats were bombed to smithereens as they tried to escape. Maybe you have heard some family stories about this, but I'm constantly enthralled at how many incredible memories of history this audience has. But here's of some of what happened and how it played out.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
The highly trained but so far inexperienced men of the 8th Division waited in Malaya. Then their waiting came to an end.
Men and women of Australia, we are at war with Japan. That has happened because in the first instance, Japanese naval and air forces launched an unprovoked attack on British and United States territory. Because our vital interests are in peril, and because the rights of free people in the whole Pacific are assailed.
At 6 o'clock in the morning, the Japanese had given us 24 hours notice to get out of Singapore or be bombed out, and they meant what they said. It wasn't much before the forenoon that their artillery and mortars opened fire and overcame their bombers. Can you imagine what 900 bombers flying over in waves of nine could mean? I cannot remember such confusion. At about 2 o'clock in the same afternoon, the natives, who had been collecting in thousands, were all trying to get away at that time. People were lying dead all over the city, and there was no time to bury them. Still, the planes kept flying over and bombing and firing on us.
I speak to you at home. I speak to you in Australia and New Zealand, for whose safety we will strain every nerve. To our loyal friends in India and Burma, to our gallant allies, the Dutch and Chinese, and to our kith and kin in the United States, I speak to you all under the shadow of a heavy and far-reaching military defeat. It is a British and imperial defeat. Singapore has fallen.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny.
Well, military historian Lynette Silver is currently accompanying a group of relatives of former prisoners of war to Malaysia and to Singapore, exploring the sites where Australians fought desperately as the Japanese closed in. And she's joining us tonight from Malaysia by phone. Thanks so much for your company tonight.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Lynette, the fall of Singapore was a huge blow, and not least because there was this belief that Singapore could not be taken. Why were people so confident that Singapore would hold out?
Well, they had what they called the Singapore strategy, which relied on a fantastic up-to-the-minute naval base that was completed in the late 1930s in Singapore, which was well protected by a huge array of guns, which would stop anybody attacking from the sea, and also a pledge from the British that if Singapore were attacked or was threatened, that an Eastern fleet would be sent out from England to shore up all the defences here. And we actually relied on this Singapore strategy. Now, the problem was that when the war broke out in Europe and then spread to the Mediterranean, England was really stretched, especially after France fell, and this promise could not be fulfilled. So consequently, no Eastern Fleet was going to be dispatched, and too much reliance was placed on the fact that Singapore was protected by this great armament of guns, which would stop any invasion from the sea. But the Japanese were smart. They came in the back door. They came in Malaya at the height of the northeast monsoon, which is happening now, and they came through what was supposed to be impenetrable, mountainous, jungle-covered Malaya.
Yeah, and there were no defences at all. Yeah, I know. And the common belief is, yes, it was very much because the big guns were facing the sea. But I was reading today that they could go inland, but they were the wrong sort of, they fired the wrong sort of weapons.
Yes, that's one of the enduring myths of Singapore, is that people will say, oh, Singapore was lost because the guns were pointing the wrong way. The guns were able to swivel 360 degrees, and in fact they were. But the problem was they were equipped with armour-piercing shells which were designed to explode on a warship instead of high-explosive shells. Now, if they'd had enough high-explosive shells, they could have done huge damage to the Japanese forces in Malaya. But what happened was that they only had armour-piercing, and they took off and whistled over our troops and landed on the ground in Malaya, which it was soft and, you know, of course, the rain and very soft soil, and they just didn't explode. The only damage was done was when one fell kind of accidentally on the roof of the Johor Bahru railway station and knocked a bit off the side. That's the only damage it did.
Right. And when was it clear that that this was going to happen, that the Japanese were planning to take Singapore? Was it then too late for troops to get in?
Well, we sent across six battalions and support troops, machine gun battalions, and to field artillery, which are the big guns, the 25 pounders that most people realise are the ones that fire off at the Queen's Salute. They saw the big guns. They were there, but we were, you know, really undermanned. And although the Australian troops were very well trained, they spent a lot of time in jungle training, the Japanese were just highly trained. They'd been trained to live off the land. They could get around on a handful of rice and a few dried veggies. They came on bicycles. When they landed in the northern part of Malaya, they weren't encumbered by a lot of big trucks and equipment. They got on bikes and they pedalled down the tarred roads through the rubber plantations. And although we had a scorched earth policy of blowing up bridges and whatnot along the way, it didn't stop them because they had fifth columnists who'd left piles of lumber. And if you couldn't walk across the stream and carry your bike over your head, you could walk across a log, or very soon the engineers built a bridge, and it was like a steamroller. I mean, they were absolutely fanatically good at what they were doing and led by a very good general who really knew his stuff.
Yes. And we're talking to Lynette Silver on ABC Radio Nightlife. She's a writer and a historian. She's actually in Malaysia at the moment, going back for the anniversary of the 75 years since the fall of Singapore with the group. And so what about the Japanese, as you've said, were incredibly well-trained, even more well-trained than the Australians. And what about the Malaysians? Did they fight against the invading Japanese?
Yes, they had volunteer forces, and one particular Malay regiment fought to the death. They wiped out in Singapore. They had Chinese who wanted to fight, and they formed a force called Dal Force, and they were pretty much wiped out at the causeway. But the great bulk of the troops defending Singapore were Indian, and a lot of them were very young. They hadn't been trained. They'd been rounded up on the streets of Bombay and Delhi and sent out to defend the empire, and unfortunately, you know, they crumpled, really, in the face of the onslaught, and it was just like a steamroll you couldn't really stop. Although the Aussies had been well-trained, some of the British thought, you know, wasn't really necessary, and the only military leader who did anything about jungle training was head of a Scots regiment. And when he was training his men in the jungle, the rest of the people on the garrison duties thought he had the ideas of a crank. So it was sort of a, you know, Singapore's never going to fall. It's protected by this huge armament. It's got this wonderful naval base. And they were sort of living really in a fool's paradise. And it was too late when they realised that really this disaster was definitely going to overtake them. Mm. And unfortunately, when it did overtake them, it took 15,000 of our troops over there who went into captivity.
It's a huge, incredible amount of people that went into captivity. Did the unconditional surrender, did that automatically mean in all Australians in Singapore would be prisoners of war?
Yes, the unconditional surrender was really taken out by General Yamashita, who was a very large man physically with an enormous presence. And the British general was a fairly ineffectual little fellow with a little bristly moustache and, you know, receding chin. He didn't look much. He's very unpresupposing.
Right.
And he was very nervous, and he went along to the conference unaware that the Japanese were so stretched with their supply line, because they'd come so rapidly through Malaya that they were very stretched. And they were in danger of having to retreat because they simply couldn't support their troops. And in the footage you see of the day, you see General Yamashita banging his hand, his fist on the conference table, and the British General Percival blinking his eyes, you know, he's really intimidated, and he signed the unconditional surrender, which meant that everybody in Singapore, all Commonwealth troops, or Empire troops as they were known then, were going to be taken into captivity, and the Japanese didn't really know what to do with them. I mean, according to the Japanese, if you killed yourself before you surrender. And so really, there were 100,000 plus who were taken captive. They really couldn't cope with them. And that's why they sent so many of them out of Singapore to work on projects in Burma and Thailand and over in Borneo, and also to Japan to work in the coal mines to use the labour force.
Yeah. And, of course, there were terrible, you know, killings of people as well in the hospital and the like.
Yes, the civilian population in Singapore were subjected to what they call Operation Cleanup, and in about two, three weeks after the Japanese arrived, the estimates go up to 50,000 of the elite educated in Singapore were simply massacred. They really don't know how many were killed. As for our troops, we had a terrible massacre at Alexandra Hospital where the wounded were, and the Indians had were retreating. Everyone was retreating, of course, back to the harbour, basically. And they'd set up a machine gun in the grounds and were firing at the Japanese, and the Japanese said that this was a breach of international convention. And they then attacked the hospital, and they murdered a huge number of people there, killed the doctors in the operating theatre, bayoneted patients on the operating table, killed the patients in the bed. It was an infamous massacre, and that took place on the 13th of February.
Right.
Black Friday, Friday the 13th was a terrible day.
Sure was a Friday the 13th, wasn't it, Lynette? And so you're in Malaysia now. Tell us where you're going to go for the sites that you've already been to and where you're going on this visit.
Well, we started over at on the west coast at Malacca, because the group I'm with, fathers and uncles, were stationed there before hostilities broke out. So we went there first. And then we worked our way down to a place called Parit Sulong, which is a little tiny village, it was then, where the most terrible massacre took place of Australian troops. Word came through that 200 Japanese were attacking on the west coast, and actually it was 10,000. And two Australian battalions were sent across to stop the movement of these Japanese, who'd already overrun a large number of Indians and also some of our artillery. They didn't hold them. There were 10,000 Japanese. They had tanks, which the British said you couldn't possibly use in Malaya. Well, the Japanese had no trouble using tanks. And this onslaught started against these two under, they were not up to strength battalions. And the loss of life was so great and the pressure was so huge that the commanding officer, who was Colonel Anderson, decided he would have to retreat back to this little village called Parit Sulong, where the British were holding the bridge over the river, which was their only means of escape. And they fought a rearguard action, which should go down in our annals of history as being absolutely incredible. They were being bombed. We had no air support from our side. They were being constantly bombed and strafed by Japanese aircraft. There were tanks after them, and these crack troops, not 200 nearsighted, runty little Japanese, which we'd been told to expect, but 6-foot guards division, who were the elite. And the retreat became worse and worse as the wounded built up and the number in the trucks got worse and worse. And as we retreated, the Japanese encircled us constantly and put in roadblocks. Now, they reached the first roadblock, which was rubber trees across the road with heavy machine guns. And Colonel Anderson looked at his men and said, I think if you can get around the back of them, you might be able to do a bayonet charge. Well, they looked at him in absolute horror because they had no sleep for 4 days and were dead on their feet.
Yeah.
And here he was wanting them to have this assault from the rear.
Mm.
And he said to them, get through this swamp, get round the back, and I think you can do it and sing Waltzing Matilda. And they went into this bayonet charge singing Waltzing Matilda at the top of their voices, and they overcame the Japanese on this roadblock, and then the big guns pounded it away. And from then on, there were about another 3 or 4 roadblocks. Every time they sang Waltzing Matilda, and afterwards the Japanese said that they had encountered troops who screamed and yelled in battle, but none had ever sang.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So it must be amazing for you and your tour, who, you know, with the family members,
yes,
to go to these places and to be on that land and feel what that means to them. Where will you be on Wednesday for the anniversary itself?
The 75th anniversary will be in Cranji War Cemetery, which is, of course, where all the war dead are buried. And it overlooks the site where the Australians were trying to hold when the Japanese came onto the island of Singapore. So it's quite a poignant spot for us, and I think it'll be very moving for these relatives because then we put up a really good fight, but it was really hopeless. It was hopeless from the very beginning, and not only did we lose people in battle, but we just lost so many afterwards as prisoners of war.
Yeah, all right. Well, look, I hope that it goes really well, and they must be so glad to have you with them, and you know so much about it, and we're going to talk to some people now who have done similar things. So thank you so much for talking to us tonight. I hope the rest of the trip goes well. We'll be thinking of you at the anniversary.
Thank you, and I hope people in Australia remember the 15th of February as a very special day this year for those who were involved in the Second World War.
Indeed. Thanks, Lynette.
Thank you. Bye.
Lynette Silva, bye-bye, writer and historian. She's in Malaysia at the moment, 75 years since the fall of Singapore this week. Hello, Martin.
Good evening.
Good evening. Your great-uncle was a survivor of Changi.
Yes, he was. He never spoke about it, but was basically skin and bones till he died about 30 years ago. And I've been back to Changi and confirmed he was there. But it was interesting to how he was treated when he came home, and he owned a haberdashery store in Sydney. A big supermarket next door wanted to take it over.
Yeah.
And when they found out about his war record, they stepped back and said, no, we won't touch him.
Is that right? There was still so much respect.
Nobody knew who told them, but they backed right off.
Mm.
And he actually outlasted them in that area, so...
Excellent.
Yeah,
when you say with skin and bones all the way till he died, he never put on weight again after he'd come back from Changi because his body was so affected.
Yes, he was just emancipated. It was really awful to see him. But
yeah,
once we knew what he'd been through, it made us some understanding. But he never spoke about it to the moment he died. It's just horrific what he went through.
And what was it like to actually go there and see the Changi Museum and feel where he was?
Well, I've been to Gallipoli too, so both I'd put equally emotionally.
Yeah.
Difficult. There's not much left of the original prison. A little bit of wall is in the current Changi prison.
Yeah.
And the chapel from the Changi prisoner war camp is actually in Duntroon in Canberra. But Singaporeans are starting to accept that that's a part of their history and people want to visit it. And so they've got a lot of photographs and war records, and we found his name in that. So.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
All right, Martin, thank you so much for your call. Terrific to hear your story. All the best to you. I'll be thinking of you on Wednesday, hey?
Thank you.
And you'll be thinking about your uncle. Hello, Gavin.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Good. You had an uncle in Singapore.
Yes, my uncle George.
What was he doing there?
Well, he was in the army, but his job in the army was actually to play tennis.
What?
Yes, he was on the Davis Cup training squad. So when they found out who he was, they said, oh, well, you can look after the stores and play tennis for the army.
Really? So it was good for morale to have him playing tennis and people could go and watch the games and the like?
I guess so.
Yeah, and he went to Changi, though?
Yes, he was in a group that was put together of non-coms But unfortunately, he was captured and then bayoneted many times.
Oh.
But it didn't kill him.
What?
He ended up... There was a massacre that he survived. So he ended up in Cheney, recovered from his wounds, and then he was then sent up to Borneo to Sandakan and survived the war till 1945 and unfortunately died in Sandakan in 45.
Oh, my gosh. And have you ever been back to see where he was?
Well, I've been to Singapore and I've seen the outside of Cheney Prison.
Yep.
But that's as much as I've done.
Right. And is there any records? Did he have a diary or anything so you had more information?
No. We've just through books that have been written about the Sandakan Prison, we found out exactly what happened.
Right.
But some of the survivors that came back from Sandakan were able to tell my grandmother what had happened.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for your call.
Okay, pleasure.
All the best. We're talking about the fall of Singapore 75 years ago this week on Nightlife. Hello, Lisa.
Oh, hello.
Your dad was in the Air Force in Singapore.
Yes, he was actually in the Air Force and he was very young. He was actually the baby of his squadron. He was in 453 Squadron and he spent a lot of time on the Air Force base there and he remembers bombs being dropped over the base. Well, he's no longer alive, but he told us about that. And he was very fortunate in that he actually got out. Their squadron leader got them out on a boat to Java, which was bombed all the way out. But they actually didn't, they weren't there on the actual fall when they surrendered.
Really? So they just got out in time?
They just got out in time. And many of the men he knew actually were captured later on. He used to see them at reunions. Some of them went to Japan. They ended up working down in the mines in Japan.
Oh, my gosh.
And he was just so lucky.
Did he always feel lucky or did he have...
Yes, yeah. He always felt he was lucky. Mm. And, you know, to be there when he was 19, and he often used to say that the planes, they were constantly repairing their planes, and he said they were all substandard planes. We got, you know...
Yep.
Planes from Britain, but they were reject planes and they were always rebuilding them.
Yeah, and the Japanese had much superior.
Oh, yes. Yep. And he said that at one stage he said they were down to the last couple of planes. They didn't have any equipment whatsoever.
Oh, gosh.
But we have lots of photographs. I've often thought I should send the photographs to the War Memorial because we've got, he took so many photographs of Singapore in that leading up period.
Oh, well, you should talk to them about it. We've sent some stuff to the War Memorial recently from Gallipoli and from the First World War from my great-grandfather. And you can give them a call and see if they'll be interested. But it's great to preserve this important memorabilia, isn't it? Thanks for your call.
Thank you
so much for calling, Lisa.
Thank you.
And just briefly before I go to the news, hello, Michael.
Hello. I just want to say very quickly that I only had one distant relative who died in Singapore at the hands of the Japanese during the occupation.
Yeah.
But my main point was I think it's very important to commemorate this event, but I do think we should learn a bit more about what it meant for the local civilian population when the surrender was made, because we all know that it was terrible, but the Chinese in particular, you know, during the first 2 weeks of the occupation, they lost about 60,000 young males, or mainly young males, during what the Japanese call the purification massacre. And during the occupation, some of the local Chinese and Indian community tried to secretly smuggle medicines and food into Cheney Prison to get to Australian and Indian and British soldiers as best they could.
Mm.
There were we don't learn much about what it meant for the Asian
population. It's always about us. Well, Lynette did say Lynette did say there was terrible deaths and massacres, and they don't even know the number of people that died of locals.
But an Australian military record estimate, I believe, that I read about, it was 48,000 to 60,000. Males under 60 during that first 2 weeks. And now it wasn't always like that, but life was very hard for them and for the Chinese people especially.
Yeah.
And
okay.
And today in Singapore, only a few months ago, every year they have a ceremony where they commemorate the civilians who died during the occupation. And people still go there and shed tears for relatives who died so long ago, even if they weren't actually alive at that time. You
of
know,
course.
So just
So well, that's good they mark it.
As best we could, I think we should learn more about that.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Michael.
Welcome.
Nightlife with Sarah McDonald on ABC Radio.